Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight our topic of discussion is director Terrence Malick, known for films such as Badlands, Days of Heaven, The Thin Red Line, and Tree of Life. He is also just as well known for a 20-year absence from filmmaking. Joining me tonight for that discussion are Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
Carl Kafer, say hello.
Say hello.
And Gregory Runfeld, say hello.
Hello. Greetings, everybody.
So, you know, I will start with you, Aaron, and I'll ask the question I always ask here, and that is, how did we first come to Terrence Malick? How did you first come to the works of Terrence Malick?
Gosh, I was 11 when Thin Red Line came out in 1998. And I had seen Saving Private Ryan, and somebody had told me that it was time to see the other World War II movie from that year. And so I saw Thin Red Line. And I can tell you that at 11, I was not ready for Thin Red Line, especially in comparison to Saving Private Ryan, which was very kinetic. But I watched it again around the time that The New World came out, which was when I graduated from high school. And both of those movies really, I then decided to track down the other two movies at that point that he had made. And I didn't get to Badlands for a long time because that was kind of hard to find until Criterion put it out.
Yeah.
But Days of Heaven really hit a chord. And so, yeah, I've been with him since he came back from his intermission.
Well, you know, I saw Thin Red Line in theaters, and this is my story for how I came to Malick. And I remember hearing the buzz, you know, it had won the Palme d'Or, and it had Best Picture buzz, and it was, as you said, the other World War II film. It had that cast, but it also had this legendary director who had done two movies as a director back in the 70s that were acclaimed, beloved, and then he vanished. Well, I was like, you know, before this movie comes out, I'm going to hunt these things down. And I managed to hunt down Badlands and Days of Heaven. I actually managed to see them in that order, Badlands first and then Days of Heaven. I think the library had an old VHS copy of Badlands and Days of Heaven. If I remember right, came on Turner Classics. So I got to see them, and then I got to see Thin Red Line when it went wide at the end of 99, at the end of 98, early 99. So I was about 17, 18. I saw Thin Red Line, and then I did not see another Malick film in the theaters, or I have not seen another Malick film in the theaters since. Every Malick film I've seen since has been at home. Part of that is because they don't tend to play too long. Part of that is also because I missed New World, and then when I saw Tree of Life, I had issues with it, and we'll get to that later. But, Carl, how did you come to Malick?
Well, actually, this changed about 3 days ago when we did a memorial for Alan Arkin, and I was looking at specific films and mentioning sort of like off-the-radar films. And one of them is Deadhead Miles. And as I was, and I actually saw that on HBO in late 73, early 74, before I saw Badlands. It was written by Terrence Malick. I didn't realize it at the time when I first saw the film. So actually, that's the first time I ever ran across him as a writer as opposed to a director. But as I said, we had early HBO. And so I saw Badlands and, of course, fell in love with Sissy Spacek. And then, of course, years later, also Days of Heaven. And I was hit specifically with the way that he approached character and also had a philosophical bent to how he presented material. And so he fascinates me in that sense more than anything else. Because of the way that he presents his films and uses philosophy and things like that. And, of course, I have a philosophy minor. So yeah, I'm going to be hitting in my wheelhouse. So that basically is how I was introduced. And I didn't realize it's Deadhead Miles. So there you go. Adam, you there?
Yeah, sorry. I was coughing, so I had to mute it for a second. No, I was going to say that actually gets me thinking about one of our other questions, but I'll get to that when it's time for that. So, Gregory?
Okay. The first film, Alex, that I saw was Days of Heaven, and I remember seeing Siskel and Ebert reviewing it on when they had their old PBS show, and They ran also an episode where they had an episode where they said, if we owned a movie theater, and one of the films that they showed was My Dinner with Andre, and I think they picked Days of Heaven as well.
I remember that episode. They did.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was funny because my brother, who was not particularly like attuned to like artsy films, at least at that point, thought it was stupid with the narration from Linda Manz, and I thought I didn't say anything, bigger than me, but I said I think I'll check it out and not just not tell him. So that's the first film I saw of his, and that was pretty much the only film. And I can't remember when I saw Badlands, but as we have all said, those were the only two films available for like years, so. Once you saw Days of Heaven, you're like, did the guy do anything else? You find out Badlands, let's watch that, and then we're just hearing the story. This guy did he leave the business for 20 years? Or there were rumors that he was still trying to get something made, like in the 80s, but he never was able to. And it was a couple of years of, like, negotiating.
He had a lot of projects that fell through. There's always been talk that he's done a lot of uncredited rewrites because, Carl mentioned, him starting out as a writer. He's always been considered one of the best writers in the business. I mean, I was going to say, I seem to remember a quote where Robert Towne was told, so you're the best writer in Hollywood. And he said, no, that's Terrence Malick, but he's out of the business for now.
Wasn't he working on, like, the special effects and stuff for Tree of Life as well and trying to get that to work? Because that
was
a long gestating film.
I don't know if it was the special effects. I always thought that it was a script called Q. Developed a lot of ideas in there that went on to be used in Tree of Life. I don't know if it was specifically the special effects, but definitely, as Carl said, his films are heavily philosophical, so he was working out his philosophies for years and years. I always looked at those 20 years as him, writing and coming up with projects. It's a lot like Kubrick wasn't inactive. He was just busy doing a lot of projects that never got off the ground. You know, hell, had Kubrick lived a few more years, you probably would have seen one or two more movies from him. I think, you know, mm-hmm. It's not an unfair comparison.
Actually, you know, you're right. It's not. The directors generally, you know, had tons of projects that they have ideas for, and even if there's a long period of inactivity, or at least not a released film, they're still active. They're still trying something. They're still writing. They're still coming up with ideas, sketches, notes, things like that. You know.
Mhm. Mhm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, creative types. We're always
yeah.
busy thinking. So I will put this one to you, Carl, and that is this. What do you think influenced Malick as a filmmaker? What influences do you see in his work?
Philosophy. I mean, this is a guy that went and believe, went into philosophy. He then went to Oxford and was studying philosophy and got in an argument with his proctor there and didn't finish at Oxford. When he left film, he taught philosophy in MIT. It's all philosophy, and particularly Heidegger and Hegel. And I see it
too.
You know, I mean, it's right there. It's right in front of you. And, you know, I'll get more into detail when we get to the Thin Red Line. But, yeah, it's that he is the philosopher filmmaker. There isn't anyone that you know, has it so on his sleeve as Malick. I mean, you can argue Buñuel and a number of other people, but nobody other than Malick really wears it on his sleeve like that.
Gregory?
I would have to concur, like, and say, like, philosophy or spirituality are his biggest influences. Because if you look at his films are similar to Tarkovsky's in that, you know, they talk about the deeper issues, the philosophical issues. Now, they're not exactly like Tarkovsky, because Tarkovsky obviously was Russian, has a Russian sensibility. Malick is American, but he doesn't really, Malick was born, he's actually from the Midwest. And
but
he was
raised
Illinois.
In Texas and Oklahoma, though.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But I remember reading he was from Ottawa, and I have a little personal story about Ottawa, Illinois. I'm from Illinois originally. Ottawa, Illinois is a little river town on the Illinois River. And my father managed to get enough money together for a secondhand houseboat back in the day. And we used to take trips down that river, right? And when I think back at it, I think I'm watching a Malick film sometimes, right? Ottawa is not a very big town. I think it's only about maybe 2,000, 3,000 people. But there's like marinas around there, including one famous one called Starved Rock Marina. So maybe it's not in Ottawa, maybe not directly in Ottawa, next the city next to it. But, you know, that was probably the most influential thing on Malick, I would think. Like, you know, being around nature and things like that. Now, I don't know where I know he lives in Austin now. I know he was living in Texas for quite some time. Probably still is, I would assume. So I would have to say, like, the biggest influences maybe are not a particular filmmaker or another filmmaker. It is more like a philosophy, spirituality thing with him. It's like he's a deep artist, and he just uses film as his, you know, as his means of expression. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Aaron.
I see the philosophy. It's obviously right there. I also see a lot of poetry. I think he's a poet. And I would say that literary naturalism specifically plays a large role in his films. The power of nature, the and man's role in it. But also, like, let's talk film here. Days of Heaven, there's no doubt, is based at least in part on City Girl by Murnau. And I would say that the Expressionists are a large influence on him. The Warner Brothers gangster pictures were a huge influence. And the old Hollywood movies in general are a huge influence on him. Obviously, he's doing his own thing. Kubrick's already been mentioned, but I don't think you can really undersell that influence either. So he's new Hollywood, right? Like,
yeah.
His influences are those that were old Hollywood. He brought in the same influences that everyone else from that era did. And he was looking for a way to make personal statements using this tried and true art form that had gotten stuck in a really bad business model for the 30 years prior. And he made two of the best films of the 70s and disappeared. And then came back, obviously. And I think we're all better for it. But, yeah, I totally agree with the philosophy thing, but I didn't want to let that get away without mentioning that he is a filmmaker and has filmic influences as well.
Yeah. No, certainly. So now I will go to Greg and ask him this question. What influences do you think Malick has had on other filmmakers?
Well, hang on a second. Okay. I noticed that, like, on the Thin Red Line Criterion Blu-ray, there's a featurette where everybody, like, talks about Malick, like Fincher, Nolan, et cetera, et cetera. He seems to have had, you know, at least everybody really deeply respects him, respects his, you know, his, and that idiosyncratic, but at least his like esoteric vision, you know, his artistry, right? As opposed to actual like influence on filmmakers, I've seen commercials that sometimes look like Terrence Malick films, right? Like later day films, because like the earlier films up until about like the first four films, those were shot in a very more like classical style, right? There's no handheld camera work or very little. I mean, there is in the Thin Red Line, but it's like during battle scenes, but there's not as much like, you know, as like the elliptical quality that you see in the Real Life and Through the Wonder, Night of Cups, Song to Song, Hidden Life, et cetera, et cetera. So I see a lot of influence. If you see some of these commercials, sometimes you see a Malick influence. Now, I'm not sure if the commercial makers have seen Malick, or whether, you know, but it does feel that way with the jump cuts and, you know, and
Malick has also made quite a few commercials.
Mm-hmm.
So, Aaron, what about you? What are your thoughts here?
My immediate thought when I hear this question always goes to David Lowery, who I don't think I've ever seen it. A filmmaker more obviously influenced by another filmmaker. I love David Lowery. I think that he's wonderful. But he wears his Malick love on his every shot. But I do think that impressionistic style, the stream of consciousness style that he's really developed since Tree of Life, especially, as Greg was just saying, has really seeped into the culture at a larger level, which is kind of funny because it's not really a style. It's very artsy, very, like, not mainstream. But for some reason, it has really caught the zeitgeist. So it's right there. Another one, anything that's been also influenced by Herzog at this point, probably also has Malick influence. Both of those guys came up with a very naturalistic style, and it's hard to separate where the influence separates.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned Herzog because, of course, Herzog and Malick both started doing films around the same time, you know, the 60s and the 70s.
Right.
So, you know, you have to then say what else was happening in the culture at the time.
For sure.
But, you know, it's interesting you mentioned David Lowery because I couldn't help but think, yeah, you know, if Terrence Malick did a kids' film or a family film, I can't help but think it would have turned out something like his version of Pete's Dragon, which I know people want to shit on that movie, but it's such a good little movie, and it's so many miles ahead of the original.
Well, you know, I was a kid when the original came out, and I remember getting terrible reviews, you know, and I tried to watch it, like, a little while, maybe a couple of years ago, and it just, you know, I mean, when people complain about remakes or reboots, it's one thing. But sometimes remaking a bad, if you're going to remake something, remake a bad movie and make it a better film,
yeah.
You know. There's nothing wrong.
Yeah, and that's
wrong.
Exactly
that's
what Lowery
good, that's
did
a good
here.
Thing.
Lowery definitely made a better film.
Yeah. Now, I haven't seen No Man's Land or any, but or is it Chloe, what's her name, Chloe?
Oh, yeah, Chloe Zhao is definitely.
Yeah, and she always mentioned Malick being a huge influence on her.
She's got that very naturalistic.
Some of the clips I've seen in No Man's Land look very Malick, and if that's the word.
I can definitely see that.
Yeah. So, Carl?
I think that the Lowery comparison is very apt. I hadn't thought about that, but when you said that, yeah, that makes sense. I'll say something that my former partner, Stephen Ronquillo, said. He's basically said, if anyone does a shot of Wheat Fields, it's all Malick now. Stephen is not a big fan of Malick. But the other thing is, you mentioned Herzog. I would mention Wim Wenders. Particularly, it seems that in his later films, there seems to be a connection, like I see a connection between Knight of Cups and Paris, Texas, for example. And the idea of place in Wenders, I think there's some sort of simpatico thing going. I can see the comparison to Herzog too, but I would go more with Wenders because it's all about the journey.
Yeah, Wenders has a very lyrical quality in his best work, like Malick, like Wings of Desire, Paris, Texas, even some
Wenders
of the Road trilogy, like parts of Kings of the Road have poetry in them, or like
Alice
even
the
American
yeah.
Friend does.
Yep. Yeah, and those are two directors that I do connect with, and I've always thought of Malick in sort of an American version of Wenders to a certain degree. And I'm not saying it's influence. I think they both came about independently, but you know, even if that's the case, you see both films coming out, and you know, you can borrow from both and that sort of thing. And I do think they're connected.
And Badlands is a road film.
Yeah.
And that's Wenders' thing. So, yeah, I can definitely do that.
Mm-hmm. So now I will go back to you, Aaron, and ask this question. What themes does he most work with? And there's the big question that will take up most of the show.
Where do we start? I've already mentioned it a few times. I really think that he's always coming back to the grandeur of nature, humanity's place in it. And he plays with this idea of violence a lot too. Man on man violence, but also nature on humanity, man versus nature, right? One of the three great themes in classical literature, man versus nature. In Days of Heaven, you see it with kind of the biblical plagues that afflict the farm. The threat of nature on Guadalcanal is almost as intimidating as the threat of the Japanese in Thin Red Line. And same in New World. The new place, this American frontier, is every bit as dangerous as the indigenous people there. Ironically, the English people are actually the most dangerous thing in the movie, but we won't get into that. So there's always a threat of violence, and sometimes it's from other characters, and sometimes it's from the setting itself. And that's a theme that goes all the way through. Maybe an exception of his three truly stream of consciousness films that follow Tree of Life. Though To the Wonder definitely has, it plays with this emotional violence, but it's not the same. So, and they all play with emotional violence, but the threat of physical violence is less. And then he picks it back up with A Hidden Life. Man versus nature, man versus man versus God. Those are the three major themes of classical literature, and they're the three major themes of Malick's work.
Mm-hmm. Gregory, your
Sounds
thoughts?
Good. Adam?
Gregory, yep, I said Gregory, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would just pretty much agree with everybody that his films are about there's a deep spirituality to his work. He's one of the few directors today that actually makes spiritual pictures. There's not that many. The only ones that come to mind offhand are Alexander Sakharov from Russia, Lav Dias from the Philippines, and Pedro Costa from Portugal, where there's this like deeply religious, not like in a strict sense necessarily, but almost a religious, you know, attitude in the films, where you feel like something, you know, where you feel a deep profundity to them. Malick is, you know, and especially in the later pictures, like starting, like, it's there in Badlands to a little degree and in Days of Heaven, but it really started mostly with The Thin Red Line, and then, you know, in The New World, and it got progressively, like, deeper with The Tree of Life, To the Wonder, you know, and then
it's
The Tree of Life.
Years to work out a philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah, you could say philosophical or spiritual. It's kind of the same thing, not exactly the same thing, but it intertwines. We'll say so. You know, so when one sees Malick's films, it's almost, it could be almost a religious experience for some people. You know.
Mm-hmm. So Carl,
and that's the thing. Was like when. Go ahead.
No, I thought you were done, Gregor.
Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, like, when people try to copy Malick in, like, the commercials or whatever, like, they copy, like, superficially, right? They'll copy, like, the wide shots or the camera movements, but they don't really get him. You know, it's like a homage they're doing, but it's almost like a cover version. Like, you see a cover band, you see a band doing a cover of like a famous song. It could be good. Most of the time, they don't make it their own. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's kind of how it runs sometimes. You know, now if you do a cover of a famous song, you always people point out, like Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix, like picked mm-hmm. up the song and made it his own. You know, or if you ever hear any like some Dylan covers, like what's one? When I Paint My Masterpiece by the Band, which is a beautiful cover. Song better than Dylan's original version, but a lot of times, like when they copy Malick, they just really kind of copy it in a superficial sense and don't get it as like profound as profundity. They try, but they don't.
So for me, asking me the question, it has to be transcendence, and by that I mean the conflicts between reason, instinct, morality, all these things, you have to work through them, and you either come to a more enlightened viewpoint, or in the case of something like Badlands, that fails you and you become serial killers. You know, it's funny how these things work, but basically, the one thing I do have to say is that theology and philosophy are sisters, more or less. They're related, and they're very, very intricately related. But it's the way you look at things. It's your perception of such, whether or not you deal with it from a more more outward or inward And for me, it's, as I said, it's all about transcendence. It's all about, you know, looking at things differently through different prisms and then coming to terms and letting that knowledge and that understanding shape you into something different. And that's what he does in all his films, every one of them. And each of the major characters have a transcendence, have a rebirth, so to speak, in either a good way or a bad way. So that's what I would say. What do you guys think?
Yeah,
I can't disagree with anything anyone's really said.
Yeah, when you talk transcendence, it runs all kind of the same gamut, where you're talking philosophy, you're talking spirituality, you're talking transcendence, you're talking religious experience with Malick's work. It's all kind of the same thing. It's just four different ways of describing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something we're going to come back to, obviously, as we get further into the show, but now I will go to you, Greg, and I'll ask this question. Who do you think Malick's most important collaborator is?
That's a tough one, because you could say that it's the DP, the director of photography, Lubinsky, Emmanuel, right? Is that his name?
Yeah, Chivo.
Yeah, yeah. Who shot The Tree of Life, who shot To the Wonder. But also, you can also make an argument for Jack Fisk, who's done a lot of production design for him, although dating all the way back, I think, 2 Days of Heaven, right? And it's, you know,
yeah.
And Fisk is one of the best production designers in the business. Or you could say one of his producers, Sarah Green, who has produced, I think she's produced or co-produced every film since The Thin Red Line, or at least since The New World. You know, to get him to come out of, not really retirement, but to get him to come out of retirement, to get the money together for his films, to let him make the films that he wants to make. You know, I think I've said before when I've been on this show, producing is a very underappreciated art in filmmaking. You know, it's not as, you know, it's really just a person who's pragmatic and who can get the money for the filmmaker. You know, it's one of those steps that people don't like to talk about, but it's absolutely necessary in order to get it done. you know, and Sarah Green has produced a lot of his work. I think she's been, like I said, I think she's been with him since The Thin Red Line. So it's probably one of those three. But in terms of just like the visual, you know, in terms of the actual aesthetic, I would say Levinsky, probably the most, you know, potent collaborator that he has. But, you know, the other two that I mentioned, definitely make an argument for them as well.
Hmm. Aaron, your choice?
It's Jack Fisk. For me, it's not even a discussion. If it's not Jack Fisk, it's David Lynch, who introduced him to Jack Fisk. Because they went to AFI together, Malick and Lynch did, and Fisk was Lynch's best friend from high school, and I think his brother-in-law at the time. Anyway, yeah, it's Jack Fisk.
And I would agree with that. I would say it's Jack Fisk, but I also want to throw out one other name that hasn't been mentioned, and that's Gilbert Ryle, who was the Dean of Philosophy at Oxford that he had the argument with and left Oxford and then went to MIT and taught for 20 years. And it was, and I've even read a couple of interviews where he talks about how this argument with Gilbert Ryle, you know, made him want to learn more and more about philosophy and prove this son of a bitch wrong. So, yeah, I would also mention Gilbert Ryle. But when it comes to the films itself, I have to go with Jack Fisk, without a doubt.
Yeah, I was gonna say I would have gone with Fisk myself. So yeah, oh, good Lord. Now I will come to this question, and it's gonna go back to you, Carl. And that is this one. Is he better as a writer or as a director?
That's a really hard question for me. Because to be honest, I don't think of him as a writer and I don't think of him as a director. I think of him as a philosopher who uses what he has in front of us, both writing and film directing, to get his message across. So yep. I think they're too intertwined. Now, that being said, he's done a lot of ghosting on particular films. He even wrote one of the first drafts to Dirty Harry, one of his first jobs. So, you know, I mean, I guess, and a lot of things that he's written for Newsweek and the articles and that, I guess I would have to lean a little more toward a writer, but damn, is he a good director. But I really think that they work in tandem when we talk about his films specifically. And so I think they're very even in terms of what he puts out. So that's what I would say.
So, Greg, what about you? Do you think he's better as a writer or as a director?
I would say probably as a director, but, you know, the writing and directing is so closely entwined because, you know, in these later films, in fact, I think in the first two films as well, he wrote the screenplays himself. So he's his only writer. Now, I'm sure it was like there was some improvisation along the way with some act, you know, because, you know, Miller shoots a ton of footage, as we well know, and it takes years for him to edit. He's one of the few directors who has like 3-4 editors on his films. And usually that's usually a recipe for disaster because it's usually a mess. But for Malick, it somehow works. Yeah, but yeah, both are definitely intertwined. But I think the visual aspects of his films are, you know, more like potent than his writing.
I have to go with director, because I think that he does a lot of writing in the editing room. Sean Penn infamously said that Tree of Life was not what the screenplay was. And we know from the drama involving the directors of photography on Days of Heaven that, you know, he runs the camera department. He may have a DP, but he's the guy who makes sure it looks the way he wants it to look. I think that's why he and Chivo work so well together, because
he's such a collaborator.
He is very much a collaborator. He's very used to working with strong-headed directors who know exactly what they want. One of the great modern DPs, by the way.
Yeah.
Chivo. And he, as Greg said, he works with three or four editors per film, and that's because he's also the one who's really editing the film. So he writes it, he shoots it to some degree, he rewrites it in the editing room. Most of his films now have director cuts, which is absurd because he's getting final cut on the original release.
I think he's the only director that has multiple director's cuts. You know, there's three
Ridley Scott has several, but yes.
yeah, Ridley Scott does that too. But Malick has three for The New World. There's two for The Tree of Life. I'm sure there's like a longer cut of To the Wonder floating around somewhere, a longer cut of Thin Red Line floating around somewhere. So, or Oliver Stone, he did that. He's done that too. Where, like, I think Alexander had three cuts.
I think Adrian Brody said that he showed up to the premiere of Thin Red Line thinking that he was going to be the lead.
Only to find out that James Caviezel was.
So there's probably the Brody cut out there somewhere.
Right.
The Brody cut.
And that Clooney's billed as a top star in the film, and he's only in one scene, and it's at the end.
30 seconds,
right?
Or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, apparently, Thin Red Line's 3 hours long, and I don't know if it's true, but I've heard there's like 5.5 hours worth of footage. So there's like another 2.5 hours out there. So I can definitely believe it, you know?
Yeah. He might even be editing a longer cut right now, along with his film that he's doing a film now, or he was. I read that it took him.
It's opening in Venice, isn't it? So it's probably done.
Yeah, that's where it takes him forever, is in the editing room. I read somewhere it took him 3 years to edit A Hidden Life. You know, and I can believe that. He shot so much footage, he just goes over. Because people say he has trouble letting scenes go, which is like why it's so difficult for him to complete a film, you know, or he has to do like multiple director's cuts, you know.
Yeah.
So I will go to you on this one, Carl, and I will ask you our first negative question here. And that is, what is our least favorite Malick film? Which Malick film works the least for you?
Just a moment, and I will tell you that momentarily. I want to get the title correct. And that would be Song to Song, and I think everybody's going to say it. So, yeah, that one does not work. That one just doesn't work.
Nope, it's beautifully shot. I mean, Lubezki could have easily won an Oscar for it. But, you know, and it's got all the elements that it should work, and yet it just doesn't come together. No, it's my choice as well. It's my least favorite Malick film by quite a bit.
I'm going to jump on the bandwagon and agree with you two gentlemen. I don't hate the film. It's a decent film, but it's just not as good as his other films, in my opinion. It's sort of like when I tell people Andrei with respect to Tarkovsky, like I say, Ivan's Childhood is my least favorite Tarkovsky film. They think, but it's a good film. Well, yes, it is a good film, but his other six are better. You know, it's like with Malick. Malick has made 9 feature films, right? And Song to Song is a decent film, but it's compared to the other 8, it's not as good as any of those. So, yeah, it's my least favorite as well.
Mm-hmm. So I will ask this question.
Same, by the way.
Next. Yep. Nope. I was going to say you get to take this question out, Aaron. So, where do you stand here? What is your least favorite?
Same. I was actually really excited about this one. Because I thought that with his editing style that he could do something really cool about the music scene there in Austin. And it turned out to just be a really boring rehash of To the Wonder that happened to have musicians involved. And I don't know. It's the one where, for me, he just decidedly went too far. With its stream of consciousness style. He totally lost the plot with it. And it just never really comes together.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's To the Wonder, the screenplay for To the Wonder, that's basically an epic tone poem, isn't it? The screenplay is
yeah.
Am I right that that's the, yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you will get the next question, Aaron, and that is, where do you rank Malick all time?
Oh, man. I never really know what to do with him because he is so individual. He's definitely one of my all-time favorites. He's probably really high in the second half of the top 100 or really low in the first half. But I'm not really...
So maybe outside the top 25, but not outside the top 30.
We'll call it in like the 40 to 60 range.
Okay.
Like,
so a little lower than I thought you might have them. Okay.
Part of that is just the volume of work. And you can nail me because Kubrick and Tarkovsky and Kieslowski are all amongst my absolute favorites. But for me, like, their masterpieces are a little more towering. The films by them that I dislike are a little less nagging. And so it's just enough to push them over the top, whereas he's maybe just in a large pile of guys I really love, or people I really love, but maybe not pushing them into, like, the top levels of the pantheon.
And, Carl, where do you put
him? Well,
It's funny because it's hard for me to say. I love philosophy, but I don't really read a lot of philosophical text. Okay, and that's sort of the feel that I have with Malick. I mean, I appreciate, but I don't really revisit that much. Okay, well, maybe the exception of Badlands. Because they're just so heady for me, and I have to really think about them and so on and so forth. As someone that uses film as a way to get across his philosophy and his thoughts, I think he's one of the best. I think he, you know, if you take a look at Tarkovsky or Bunuel, things like that, the social commentary, all that, he's up there. But he's not one that I want to revisit a lot, okay? I would probably put him, if we're talking about a top 100, he's probably like 75 to 60, simply because of that fact. But when I'm in the mood, oh, God, I'll watch it like crazy, right? So that, you know, that's what I would say.
And Gregory?
Well, you have to put him in the pantheon of great directors as to where I don't really know. I don't like to use the term subjective, but it kind of is. Because you can't really name one director as the greatest director of all time, but you can name, like say top 10 directors, but then like I can put, if somebody asked me personally, like, where would you put Malick? I'd say put it in my personal top 20. I really like his work a lot, but that's just, you know, reflective of my taste as opposed to like a critical assessment, which is a different thing. It's sort of like when I tell people like in my top 10 list, one of my top 10 films is The Last Emperor by Bertolucci. But I say to people, it's not my favorite Bertolucci film. 1900 is my favorite Bertolucci film. And people think that doesn't make much sense, and I guess it kind of doesn't. But like with Malick, in my top 20, I would put him in there because I really like his work. But as like an assessment, you know, like a whole critical thing, I don't know if we, you know, where he would fall. And he actually is interesting too because he came out of the movie Brat Generation, along with like Spielberg, De Palma, Coppola, Lucas, and all that, and he's the deepest of the lot, you know, and he really just kind of does his own thing, and he's actually more prolific now than he ever was when he was younger. So, I remember a woman I worked with said, "Oh, he's older now, so he's like he realizes he's getting older, so he's trying to get the films done more quickly than he did back 20 years ago." I don't know. Really know if that's true or not, but you know he is. I mean, he's making a film every couple of years now, so I think it's a good thing. You know, there's some people who really had wished that he, I know they love the 70s films and they love the idea of him leaving Hollywood and staying away permanently from it. But then when he came back, they seemed to be disappointed. I don't know how to explain that. You know, I'm not disappointed. I'm glad he came back because his, you know, The Thin Red Line is a masterpiece in my opinion, et cetera, et cetera. So.
So we are going to proceed soon to our countdown. We're going to do our top five Malick films. Yep, now he only has 9 films that have been released. He has a 10th coming, and there is a documentary that he did. So he's got 10 or 11 works, depending on how you look at it. With one unreleased so far, but so 5 might seem excessive, but it is what it is. However, it is also now a little after, it's actually a little before 9. So before we get on to this part, which could take a whole hour, depending, and I don't want to have to run into overtime. Carl, are you ready for the housekeeping?
I could do it real quick if you give me a moment. I wasn't there, but I can do it. We don't have a lot going on, so that makes it easy. Okay, so on Sunday, we have TC going to be doing his Rock This Town Radio. And it's the basics of rock. So it's rock music with featuring the bass guitar. And that's what he's doing on Sunday, and that's at 8 p.m. Then on Wednesday, the 12th, I'm going to be doing an interview with Limes Marshall. Limes was part of our group, and then was working on some things. And he's back, and he's got some things to announce. And we'll be working with him on a couple of things. So we're going to have an interview with him on Wednesday. On Tuesday, the 11th, and this isn't set in stone, but it almost is we're going to be doing one more commentary watch for Alan Arkin, who just passed away, and we're going to be doing Little Miss Sunshine. So we're going to do that on Tuesday at 8 p.m. So that's what we've got scheduled so far. So there you go. That was quick.
And coming up on Cathode Ray Mission, we have the next few weeks scheduled. Coming up next week on the 14th is a look at the British miniseries Boys from the Black Stuff. That will be at 8 p.m. on next Friday, the 14th. 1 week later, on the 21st, we will be doing a look at the two miniseries from Jane Campion, Top of the Lake, and Top of the Lake, China Girl. That will be on the 21st. Both of those are Fridays at 8 p.m., the next two Fridays. So we're keeping our schedule through July. And I guess, yeah, that's it. So I do hope everybody joins us all, you know, watches what Carl and TC and Limes are doing, comes back and listens for what we're doing here at Cathode Ray Mission. And now on to this final bit of the show. Now, we're going to do this like I've liked doing it. We're going to do it the old Siskel Ebert countdown way. We're going to start at number five. Everybody's going to give their five. Everybody's going to give their four, then their three, then their two, then their one. So first round will be five, second round will be fourth, and so on and so forth. And I'll start with you, Aaron. So what is your number five Malick film?
Badlands. The one that started it all. Great turns by Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek. Wonderful, lyrical road film. And in my opinion, it is the better crimes wave road film of the new Hollywood movement. Yes, better than Bonnie and Clyde, but number five for Terrence Malick.
Well, I'm going to say this. I was going to go next, but that is also my number five. And, you know, it's a masterpiece. I mean, a lot of his films are, but this one, it's one of those movies, you know, some movies you can watch over and over again because they're fun. Others you can watch because they're beautiful. Others you can watch because there's something profound to them. I don't know if I'd ever call this one fun, but the other two elements are definitely there with this one, and it's one that I've come back to several times over the years. So, Gregory, what's your number five?
Number five for me is Days of Heaven. Like I mentioned before, that doesn't mean I think, you know, it's an inferior film or anything compared to his other works. It's still a wonderful picture, and it was the first film of his I saw. It still is so beautiful to look at today. It holds up remarkably well. I would love to see it in the 70 millimeter print someday. You know, it was not shot in 70, it was shot in 35, but they blew it up to 70 for several cities back in the day. And also, unfortunately, I think if I remember right, it bankrupted Bert Schneider, who was the producer of the film, the VBS, because his production company, VBS, which produced Easy Rider and several other pictures in the 70s. But, you know, unfortunately, that's just the way the business goes sometimes, but it's still a wonderful picture. And
It's a gorgeous movie, you know, it's a quiet and yet brutal film. I revisited it as part of the lead up. I hadn't seen it in a long time, and my wife watched about 90% of it. She came in really early in the movie, and she was like, "Wait, is that Richard Gere?" I was like, "Yeah." And so she sat down, and she got drawn into it, which surprised me because, you know, usually she's not into certain types of period pieces unless it's like 50s, 60s stuff, It has to be a little more action gangster stuff if it's going to be back in the 20s and 30s. But she got drawn into this, and that really surprised me. But no, it's a beautiful, beautiful movie, but it's also a very brutal, brutal film. And everybody talks about the Gere character being the main character. No, it's his girlfriend. It's his girlfriend that marries the farmer. It's really her story and the sister's story. You know, the sister's the narrator, but she's not talking so much about the brother as she is about what happened to her and the girlfriend. And notice that when he goes away, we don't see what happens, which just it proves to me as a viewer that it's not really his story. Wonderful movie, though. Wonderful movie. Carl, you're number five?
Okay, I'm gonna throw in the curveball here. Knight of Cups. I think this is probably his most underrated film. I think it's a really good one. It's also extremely personal because one of the major plot points is something that happened in real life to Terrence Malick, and that's the death of his brother. I think this one is his most personal film. I think everybody in it does a great job, including Brian Dennehy, who I think is just amazing in this film. I really, really like this film, and this is the one to me that really, like, shone a light on something personal for Malick, and it comes through. And I know it's not nearly as thought of well as some of his other films, but really, I would suggest everyone to watch it and reassess it if you've seen it before, or just go right into it and just know that it's really, you know, this and The Tree of Life are the two personal films for him. And I think this one is even more personal and more real to him than Tree of Life, which I think is more philosophical. So that's what I would say. That's my number five.
Aaron, your number four.
From first to last, my number four is The Hidden Life. His first truly narrative film since at least Tree of Life, depending on how you view Tree of Life. Definitely since New World. New World had strong narrative elements. Back to World War II, back to the real heavy philosophy,
this time he's exploring violence through pacifism. And one man's bravery against the Nazi machine, and coming in the political moment in America that it did, you can't help but feel like Malick was making a very pointed statement about where things were and how things were going here at the moment.
Yeah. No, I probably like it more than most others here, which may be giving things away a little bit. It may be his most narratively cohesive or conventional. I hate to use that word at all in connection with Malick. Film sense, probably Badlands or maybe Days of Heaven, even though I think Days of Heaven has some real lyrical aspects to it. But it's marvelous from start to finish, and for a film that's as long as it is, because, you know, this is not a director that makes short movies, folks. A short movie to him is 2 hours and 15 minutes. For me, it flew by. But my own number four. I'll save my number four. I'm cheating a bit. I've got a tie. So I'll give Gregory a chance to say his, and then I'll go with mine. So Gregory, what's your number four?
And number four is the other 1970s film of Malick, is Badlands. Beautiful, lyrical, you know, kind of a film, well, maybe not a film noir, no, it's not really like that. But, you know, it is, you know, about an outlaw couple. It's based, I think it was based, loosely based. I don't think it's a direct, like, film about a couple. Charles Merriweather, was that the person that it was sort of loosely based on?
Starkweather.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. It's also unique, and nobody's mentioned this, is that it is the only film that Malick has appeared in. He comes to the door. Sheen is in somebody's mansion. He's killed that person. And Malick just comes to the door because he had an appointment. And Sheen says, yeah, we got an epidemic in here. It's the flu. You can't come in. And you can tell Malick's character is like, okay, guy just leave a message. And I remember reading that Malick was not originally supposed to portray it, but the actor that was supposed to be there never showed up for some reason. So they had to shoot it that day, so Malick just stepped in and did it. But anyway, it's still a wonderful film. The use of music, there's a piece of music throughout it, and I don't remember, like, who composed it, but it's a very well-known piece of music. It's beautifully used. You know, Sheen is wonderful. Spacek is wonderful. You know, Warren Oates, he just had his birthday like the other day. He plays her father, you know, in the film. And I'm trying to remember. I think those are the only two main characters. But yeah, it still holds up beautifully, you know. And Martin Sheen did look like James Dean at the time, you know.
Yes, he did. We did that movie. So I'm going to cheat here. I have a tie, and it's a tie that is going to shock everyone that knows me. My number four is a tie between The New World and Tree of Life. Tree of Life is particularly interesting because it was a film that was probably down around 6 or 7 on my Malick list prior to revisiting it recently. I don't know what it was that was keeping me from appreciating the movie. You know, I understood it on an intellectual level, but it just didn't resonate with me emotionally. Maybe it was, you know, something I was going through at the time that I saw it. You know, I'm sure some people would say, well, you had to grow up. I don't subscribe to that. I think that some movies, you know, they can touch too raw a nerve, and you can have a negative response because it's too close to something. And I think that may be what was happening. And now that there's been some distance, I was able to more fully appreciate the movie. But, yeah, it's a great movie. We'll get into a discussion of Tree of Life because I'm sure others will have that further up. But The New World, you know, that was a Malick that I hadn't seen until now. It was the one Malick going into tonight that I had not seen prior to this this prep. And I'm going to say that it took me by surprise. I expected it to be beautiful. I expected to have a great cast. I expected wonderful music, lots of philosophy. I also didn't expect it to just be as entertaining as it is. And I don't mean entertaining in like a swashbuckling adventure type way, but just, you know, it hit everything. And yeah, you know, there's the romance there. That there's no real historical evidence that it ever happened. And so what? It's just one way of exploring more of Malick's themes, more of his philosophies. And you know, for being 15 years old, Kiaranka Kilcher, who plays Pocahontas, was extraordinary. She is both of this world and not. It's a really marvelous performance. You know, he actually got Christian Bale to smile and not be scary while smiling. It seemed genuine. Christian Bale as John Rolfe is really good. This might be Colin Farrell's best work for quite some time, up until some of his more recent work. And that's saying something because he's been a great actor for a long time, and that was a hell of a role and a hell of a part. I mean, he really had a lot to play. And that's the thing about New World. They're figures in history. They serve the philosophy, and yet they're still people, which isn't always the case in Malick's movies, but it is here, and that's something that I think needs to be taken note of. So,
hey, Adam, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Now, how did you see all the versions of both of those films, or just one? Because there's three versions
I did get a chance to see just the theatrical cut. I'm waiting to see the longer cut for later. I wanted to.
Now,
Which
one's the theatrical cut?
The theatrical cut is the shorter one.
The 135-minute version, right? Okay.
And I saw that one, and then I made the decision not to also see the long cut of New World because I wanted to have a chance to revisit A Hidden Life. You know, it is what it is. And I'm also prepping for next month's director spotlight as well, which I managed to finish his films as well. So that's a good thing. So Carl, what is your number four?
Badlands.
Mm-hmm.
Badlands, absolutely. What a debut. Seriously. And Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek and Warren Oates are just tremendous in it. It's very, very lyrical. It's very, it's not expansive in a lot of ways. It really just focuses on those three characters, and then basically Sheen and Spacek once they kill the Warren Oates character. There's a line in there where at the end he gives somebody a pen and he says, hold on to that. It'll make you money sometime, you know, because it was mine. And such a really, really understanding of our culture and how we elevate these serial killers and the idea of fame just in one line, I think is just amazing. It's a great film. It's a great film.
Oh, it really, so it really is.
That's my number four.
So back to you, Aaron. What is your number three?
Oh, Days of Heaven. What a perfectly beautiful film. It's not my top film by Malick, but it may weirdly be his most perfect film.
Yeah.
It's a frameable photograph. 24 times a second for what, 96 minutes. Just a gorgeous film, and the story is so tight. It's probably his best narrative as far as storytelling goes. As I said, it's at least very loosely based on City Girl by Murnau. It's better than that film, which never quite reaches the level of greatness that it probably should. And Richard Gere, man, what an introduction to one of the great movie stars of that era.
He's gotten too much shit over his career. I've always thought he's really good.
Absolutely. In part because he is one of the very last, like, genuine movie stars, I think. But I think there's a lot of talent there, too. He is a lot more than just a pretty face, and I think he shows that here quite well.
Yeah. It's also my number three. But we've talked about my thoughts there. We'll move on. Greg, your number three?
My number three, this could be a curveball, but or maybe not, Knight of Cups. I find myself returning to that film a lot.
Oh, yeah, I liked it even more than Carol.
Yeah. I saw it in the theater, and I remember my mind was racing about something else. I didn't really fully get it, and then I've seen it a few times on DVD, and I've really gotten it. It's one of those, you know, films, there's been certain films in life where you see them the first time and you're like, okay, I didn't really get it, but that Spidey sense, I call it that, goes off and saying, like, you need to see that again, like 2001 Space Odyssey, like that. So when you see it a second time, you're like, okay, all right, I'm starting to get it, you know. And Knight of Cups was like that, you know. And it's a very deep film. And was it you, Aaron, or Carl? You mentioned Brian Dennehy, right? And how extraordinary his performance is in that.
Carl.
And you mentioned how extraordinary that performance was, and it really was. It was really something. Dennehy's always been one of my favorite, like, old school actors. I mean, never like a massively famous guy, but he was always, like, excellent in everything he did. He was in Peter Greenaway's Belly of an Architect, which he was wonderful in. People know him as the cop in Rambo. You know, that was one of his most famous roles. And I also saw him play on, he was in the ice production of The Iceman Cometh several years ago,
really
Brooklyn
good.
Academy of Music. Yeah, he played Larry. He didn't play Hickey, the main character. He played Larry, the guy who, like, lives in the bar. And that was one of the production was incredible. Nathan Lane played Hickey, right? And it's one of the most extraordinary plays.
They have a recording of that that you can find. I don't know if it's easily available anymore, but it's worth hunting down.
It is. I mean, Denny was great that night. Lane, I always said Lane has extraordinarily dramatic gifts, and he never really gets to, like, show it. Everybody always, they always cast him in kind of a comic role, and he's good at that, too, you know. That's, I'm not saying, like, he's bad. I'm just saying, he's got depth to him. And, you know, I saw it that night. You know, they did a full text adaptation of it, too. It's a long play. It's 4 hours. So, you know, and there's that one love line. Everything is really good.
Favorite, it's my second favorite O'Neill. But while my favorite is Long Day's Journey, the one I actually did a, like, 25, 30-page paper on for a grad course, ended up being Iceman Cometh instead of Long Day's Journey, even though I think Long Day's Journey is the greatest American play. But that's just me.
But, yeah, Night of Cups is such a beautiful film. And even though Bale doesn't really say much during the film, you know, he's a very expressive actor. You can just look at his eyes and know what he's thinking. And then there's also a smaller role by Armin Müller-Sahl. He plays a priest in the film. He comes near the end. Yeah, those scenes are really very powerful. They're as powerful as, like, Into the Wonder, the priest, another priest played by Javier Bardem, right?
He's so good.
I always love, Javier is so good in that film. In that one scene where he's, like, he's talking Christ, Christ, follow me. Where am I going wrong? You know, his voiceover is so, like, poetic and beautiful, you know. And part people had said that story of the priest in To the Wonder is actually more interesting than the main, you know, love, you know. Yeah, I think it is, too. Not diminishing, like, the love story, which I do think is sweet. Or not sweet, but it is interesting. But, you know, Javier Bardem is much, his story is much more interesting, I think, than Ben Affleck and, how do you say her name? Oleg Janesco or something like that?
Oleg Kurlyanko.
I can't remember her name. Yeah. But, Night of Cups is such a lovely is the right word. It's elliptical. You know, it's a bona fide art film, and we don't get many of those today, you know? So when they come around,
Terrence
Malick's
released a movie, or David Lowery's released a movie, or David Lynch has released a movie, or a few others, you know?
Or even Scorsese, who made Silence right around that same time, I think.
Oh, God,
yeah, that
I love
was bona fide
Silence.
Art.
Oh, my God.
That's a bona fide art movie. I thought that was one of Scorsese's best films, too. So.
It's my number three Scorsese. I love that movie. I really, really love that movie. I remember when I saw that film, there weren't many people in the theater. Maybe 10 other people besides myself and the person I went with, and that's a maybe. There might have been 8 or 9 people total. And when the credits began, we all just sat there for a couple of minutes. And I don't mean, like, 10 seconds. No one said or did anything at the end of that movie. And then people quietly got up and we started turning to each other and going, what the hell did we just watch? There haven't been many other films that's happened with. Son of Saul it happened with. But not many others. I think it happened at the end of Saving Private Ryan, believe it or not. So, Carl, what is your number three, Malick?
A Hidden Life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's amazing. And I actually knew this story. This gentleman in this story is very, very much well-known in terms of German and Austria, and in fact, the character that it's based on was canonized by the Catholic Church. And the idea of – this is the one film of Malick's where morality is the main focus. And, of course, the focus is this character – refuses to fight for the Nazis. And, of course, what happens to him is an absolute, you know what's going to happen to him. He's going to get killed because of it. And it's an amazing film. And I really liked the one thing I really liked about the film
was that there were no actors in there that we knew. You know, it's not like it was a Colin Farrell or someone. He used German actors, speaking in English, but German actors, and some of it is actually in German. And I just thought it was
and not always
really
subtitled, which is interesting.
Yes, and it was very, very much felt authentic. I think this is his most authentic film, and I think it's a film that's really about moral choices as opposed to philosophical choices or theological choices. This is about moral choice, and I think it makes it certainly his best of his later films, but also his most accessible film for people to watch.
You know, when I saw it when it came out, I thought after it became available to watch, I turned to my then fiance and said, because she was sitting there on her phone, she didn't really pay attention to the movie, and she said, "Well, is it finally over?" And I said, "Yeah," and that was amazing. And she said, "Was it?" And I was like, "Yeah," not least of which is because this director does not make accessible movies, and yet I think this is a movie that a lot of people could enjoy, could get into, and from what I understand, it is one of his more financially successful films. So there may be some truth there.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a film I hold in very high regard. we'll soon see exactly how high. So, Aaron, what is your number two, Malick?
The Tree of Life. It's a wonderful film. It's a better experience. It's truly an experiential film. And it's overwhelming. I still get lost for words with it at sometimes. I don't know if there has ever been a better depiction of grace in a film than Jessica Chastain's character in that. She is just goodness personified, and not in a way that's like just goody two-shoe, good person all the time. Just like she is goodness. She is an incredible person and a
She's
wonderful
She's good in
mother.
A very human and real way.
Yes, and you can see him pouring out all of his love for his actual mother into her in the same way that you can see him pouring out his terror and at time hatred for his father. And that tension between grace and law that takes up so much of the discussion of Christianity, especially in America. Like, you have people who will fight tooth and nail over those two issues. And here they are personified in one little boy's house to the point that he has to explore the origins of the universe when one of his close friends dies. It's just truly an overwhelming film. I've seen it on, I saw it with a friend, in the theater when it came out in 2011. I have seen it on a tiny portable Blu-ray screen. It doesn't change the way it plays. It's just so grandiose. And yet it's so quiet, and it truly is in many ways a work of humility of Malick placing his childhood in the context of the schemes of the universe and saying, look how tiny we are, but how big we think we are. And I'm just going to keep repeating myself, so I'm going to stop now.
Well, my number two is A Hidden Life. And I think we've said what I need to say about that. So we will go on to Greg. So, Greg, what is your number two?
My number two is The Thin Red Line. I remember when it came out and how excited everybody was. Malick has a new film and a World War II epic. You know, you wouldn't think that, like, that would be his comeback film, but it was. And I remember some critics were sarcastic when the film got nominated for Best Picture. They're like, boy, did he pick the wrong year to release a World War II film because, you know, it got overshadowed by Saving Private Ryan. Which, you know, Malick couldn't help that. I mean, that's just kind of how that rolls sometimes. Kind of like Full Metal Jacket when that came out in 87, or like Platoon came out the previous year, so it got a little overshadowed. But today, people still talk about Full Metal Jacket. They still talk about Thin Red Line, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, I saw it in the theater, and despite, like, a couple of interruptions by some locals, but I won't go into it because, you know, it's just people saying stuff that they shouldn't say. They were misbehaving in the theater. But, yeah, it was a beautiful, extraordinary film. And there was one thing, though, that did happen during it. I went to go see it with my wife, and about 2 hours into it, she leaves. She says, oh, I have to use the restroom. So I'm like, okay. So about 15 minutes later, she still isn't back. So I got in the lobby, and she's standing out there, and she's like, I'm like, what's wrong? And she's like, I can't take it anymore. I'm like, because there was a part where the soldiers are beating up Japanese prisoners, right? And she said it was just too real and too harsh for her. And it's a very harsh scene. And I remember her saying, like, she just couldn't take it. And I said, but you saw Private Ryan with me a couple months before that. And she goes, well, that's Hollywood. This is real, you know? And I'm like, yeah, it kind of is. You know, there's a much more artistic element in Thin Red Line than there was in Private Ryan. Even though I do like Private Ryan, I like the battle scenes in that film. I think they're extraordinarily well done. The first one, you know, when they're on the beach, and the last one, which doesn't get mentioned as much, is still extremely well done. But Thin Red Line is such a, you know, there's poetry there, there's philosophy, you know, and it's also a very well executed action film, you know, very well mounted war film. With, you know, a lot of great actors in it. You know, Jim Caviezel is fantastic in that film. You know, as we know, he was not the main character originally. Adrian Brody was, but Terrence cut him out. Travolta is very good. Nick Nolte is very good. Koteas, right? What's his first name?
Elias
Koteas.
Yeah, thank. Yeah, because I remember seeing him in a lot of like Canadian films from Adam McGoyan before I saw Thin Red Line. And he's got a really great intensity. He also was in Crash as well. You know, he's got a great intensity. He's wonderful in that film.
Sean Penn is great.
So, yeah, Penn is – yeah, that's true. Yeah, I forgot. Penn is great. Well, Penn was complaining about Tree of Life. It's like, you know, hey, you made the cut in Thin Red Line, and actually it's one of Penn's best performances. He's that hard-bitten – or that hard-boiled sergeant. He plays it really well, you know?
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah, and the thing is, it's a hard-boiled sergeant that is more than that. You know, you can tell that he really, you know, he's not a jerk. He's just very, very practical and pragmatic, and he does what he needs to do to keep his men, all of them, safe, including the Caviezel character, Whit, who probably should have faced some charges, but really did get off easy, considering what had transpired before the film. But no, it's a hell of a movie. You know, your wife's not wrong. There is a reality to it.
It's something called Malick's work transcendent. It is. It's transcendent in that, it transcends the real, and it's an art film, and it makes the real even more real, you know. So it's a very difficult film to watch.
I think it's an amazing, amazing movie. It's one that I would not mind seeing a really good Blu-ray, and I mean a really good Blu-ray, available mm-hmm. for.
The Criterion or whatever it's worth.
Well, I was going to say, but does it have a Malick commentary? No, because we'll never get one. Mm-hmm. But I do want to see. I mean, but I want one that's even better than that. I want one that's even more loaded than the Criterion. I'm greedy.
Mm-hmm.
So, Carl, what is your number two Malick?
Tree of Life. Tree of Life. It's an amazing film. And it's the other film that really focuses on the death of his brother. But even more importantly, there are dinosaurs. Okay, and I mean that sincerely. Okay, because it was the return of one of the great special effects people ever. He came out of retirement mm-hmm. for this. And just an amazing visual experience and everything, you know, you talk about how he connects his personal life to the universe and the beginning of time, and it's just, it absolutely blew my fucking mind. I remember at the end of that film, I couldn't get up until the movie almost started again. Seriously. I was just like, what? You know, I mean, I've heard this a couple times today. You know, what the hell was that? You know, but it's more like, oh, my God, I just, like, went to heaven. And, of course, literally, you go to heaven in that film. And
yes,
you see the beginning of time, and you see all of this, and you figure, boy, am I fucking insignificant. But I still make a difference. And that's the point of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's an incredible film. Jessica Chastain is amazing. Brad Pitt, Sean Penn, but one person we've not mentioned is Hunter McCracken.
Oh, he's amazing.
He's phenomenal. You talked about the 15-year-old in the New World.
Yeah.
You know, I can't think of anyone that works with young actors that brings out the best of them other than Malick. Seriously. McCracken is just amazing in this film.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my number two, no doubt.
And
no doubt.
I think I know that it seems like it's going to be, if my guess is right, unless one of us throws out something like To the Wonder as our number one, I'm assuming this is going to be a 3-1 in favor of a single movie. So, Aaron, what's your number one?
It's The Thin Red Line. It's been one of my top five war films since I went back and revisited it in high school. As I said, at 11, I was not ready for that film. To me, I don't view it as being like realism. It's poetry, and it's naturalism, poetic realism, maybe. It's more than real. And
it deals with truths without dealing with directly real people. It depicts real events without being history, and yet it is.
Right. And I totally agree with, like, the different, like, it is more real than Private Ryan. And I love Private Ryan. Like, but Private Ryan is Spielberg. It is Hollywood. Like, it is a good old-fashioned war film. Tree of Life is not that. There is that in it. The scenes, like, the natural beauty that surround the destruction of humanity. The comments on what are we doing to this planet? And why do we think we're so great? What makes us worth doing this? All over a lousy airfield. And we know the historical importance of that airfield in the grand scheme of that war. But, like, in the grand scheme of the universe, it's so small and insignificant. And if Days of Heaven is his most perfectly mounted narrative, and if Tree of Life is the most overwhelmingly beautiful film he ever made, transcendent film, as Carl mentioned, then Tree of Life is the film that really interweaves those and is an incredibly successful narrative and is also incredibly overwhelming and incredibly transcendent, and plays with the ideas of naturalism and transcendentalism and all of the other philosophies that Malick intertwines with his films throughout his career. And kind of throw, like, we have this myth in America that World War II is the good war. And we get it, right? Like, we're fighting Nazis, we're fighting Nazis across the planet. But, like, he's throwing that back in our face. And, like, this is what your good war looks like. This is what your heroes look like. And this is what we're doing to our planet. And it's just us.
Yeah. You know, that's something that really struck me during my revisit of Thin Red Line, which I've always really loved. And it made me think about Malick's work as a whole, such as back in his themes. And we haven't really touched on this, but his interest in nature, both in the practical and in the spiritual sense. And I don't know, you know, you can talk about the creation of Earth and the dinosaurs in Tree of Life being perhaps the greatest expression of it in his films. But for me, the connection between man and nature and that tension may never have been better in any of his movies or more explicit than it is in Thin Red Line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, it is also my number one Malick film. it was not my number one Malick film until this revisit. It switched places. It had been Days of Heaven. Hidden Life had been number two. This had been number three. It's not that those other two went down. It's just that this went way up during my viewing. What a movie. What a movie. Gregory, what is your number one?
The Tree of Life. Hands down. I saw that film when it came out in, when did it come out? 2011. And was you again, Carl? I think it was you, or said that you were so stunned that you couldn't like get up and leave until the credits, until the film started again. I had a similar story. I went to go see the film with my friend Terry, and he's a sensitive guy. He's got a sense of art. He's a musician himself, and we both saw it together, and we literally. We saw it down in Brooklyn at Famrose Cinemas, Brooklyn Academy of Music Cinemas.
Nice movie.
It's a really nice theater down there. And we literally sat on the steps for 15, 20 minutes and didn't say a word to each other. We sometimes would look at each other, but we couldn't say anything because we were just so overwhelmed by that film. And I had mentioned, like, silence. You know, Scorsese was an old-school art film, The Tree of Life, you know, an elliptical, you know, impressionistic art film, which you rarely get, and you know, and this is from a major. This is from Fox Searchlight, an offshoot of a major film studio, which, you know, and they had great, you know, it has like well-known actors, from 10, Jessica Chastain, Brad Pitt, and, you know, it's still an art film. It's still quintessentially him. And I remember Roger Ebert wrote about it, and he said that it had the scope of 2001, A Space Odyssey. I really wasn't directly comparing the two pictures, right? But he did say it had the scope of that film, and he was right. And, you know, nobody's really mentioned To the Wonder tonight. And I remember Roger Ebert's last review was To the Wonder. Yep. It was the last printed review that he did before he died. And it's actually one of his better reviews. If you haven't read it, he liked the film, by the way. Check it out. It's on his website. The Tree of Life is such a beautiful picture. And the scenes in the universe are some of the most beautiful scenes I've seen in a cinema probably in a long time, in a very long time. And as you mentioned, Douglas Trumbull came out of retirement to work on this film because it was all practical effects, or mostly practical effects, which Trumbull excelled at, you know. And I think practical, I've always said this when in these discussions, practical effects are so much better than digital effects. Because CGI often, it can be done well, but it often looks like a cartoon, you know. And you can always tell a CGI creation from a practical effect creation. And it always takes away from it, because a lot of times it's so exaggeratory, right? Where, like, there's things happening that defy the laws of physics, you know, and you start laughing at it. Because it's just so, you know, the actor is never in any, like, he's not in a set, or she's not in a set. They're in a studio in front of a green screen, and you just throw it all in later. It's like a really fancy rear screen projection, you know? Except it's just, you know, much more expensive and much more, you know, it's all on a computer. But it takes away from the film. So, but for The Tree of Life, I've only seen the original theatrical cut, the 138-minute version. I do have the Criterion Blu-ray, which has the 3-hour version. I'm tempted to see it. You know, most people have said that the longer version really doesn't add much. You just see more Chopin, right? But I felt like the 138-minute cut was perfect. So, and I almost put Tree of Life in my top 10 films of all time. Didn't do it yet, but someday I might. I think it's in the top 20, definitely in the top 30. Mm-hmm. And it's like one of those films you can watch in a theater over and over again. If they ever revived it, I probably would go check it out. You know, it's such a beautiful film.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much like art and poetry in it. You can think about it for days, and you can just watch it over and over again. And, you know, we having old school art films is a rarity nowadays, as we've talked about. So you cherish and you savor films like that more than you probably would back in the days where we were having art films released on a regular basis was normal. Today it's not. So you really cherish something like Tree of Life. It's a beautiful film.
Oh, agreed. Absolutely.
Hmm.
So I guess it's my turn, right?
Yes, it is, Carl.
Okay. It's The Thin Red Line, but I have to explain this. So when The Thin Red Line came out, I was in Chicago going for my master's in church music. And this should not surprise anyone. I was basically Sherpa to a bunch of younger undergraduates who basically, you know, followed me anywhere. And so I said to a couple of them, let's go see this film, because I really like the filmmaker. I think he'll say some things very interesting in the film. And they had both seen Saving Private Ryan, and they wanted to see another war movie. And so Bob and Richard and I went to see it. And we came out of there, and they looked at me, and they said, that movie changed my life. And the reason it changed life is, and we've talked about this a little bit, in terms that it's not Hollywood. Now, I'm not a Spielberg fan, and I don't like Saving Private Ryan. I think it's way too manipulative. But this film, the one thing that really comes a point is that each character represents a certain aspect of humanity. Cassavetes is basically someone who's being acted upon. Sean Penn is about fatherhood. Nolte, of course, is the corporate person who doesn't give a shit about anyone under him. But the one that really affected me more than anything else is Elias Koteas, who basically is he's the heart of the film in a lot of ways. He really wants to protect and he calls people out. It's not the right thing to do. And that wonderful scene between him and Paul, Nick Nolte, it's just like, it's heartbreaking. And you take a look at this and you see the philosophical sense of him trying to work out everything. And by him, of course, I mean our director, you know, he's just trying to work out everything in terms of this setup that the novel by James Jones sets up. And of course, a lot of that has to do with treat nature and what war does, not only to nature itself, but to the natural inhabitants of wherever the war is. If you take a look at the natives, which are shown at the beginning of the film, is very, very accepting in that. And then at the end, when all this is happening, like, they don't want anyone to be on that fucking island because it's destroyed the fucking island. And it's destroyed their you know, so they don't trust anyone. It's just like the sense of new world, too. You know, and so he brings all this together. And Terrence Malick just does a magnificent job. And it becomes something much different than just even an art film. It's a treatise on humanity and on how the good and the bad all work together to make things pretty mucked up, you know? And I think it's a brilliant film. And there isn't a better film that he's done, at least in my opinion. So that's what I would say about The Thin Red Line.
No, it's a hell of a film. It really is. So, you know, I think that's
it's definitely better than Saving Private Ryan. I mean, you know, as you said, as I said earlier, I did like the action scenes, battle scenes in Private Ryan, but the rest of it was just, I don't know, I just like the whole middle part. It's hard to say why, but it is somewhat manipulative, like you said, you know.
You know, he grabs you by the pubic hair and tells you how to feel. I fucking hate that about Spielberg. Sorry,
yeah.
I'm going on a Spielberg right now. Sorry.
It's okay.
So, my next question, and it was going to be to you, Greg. You know, I think that basically wraps it up. But before we go, is there anything we haven't touched on that you want to say before we go? And like I said, I'll throw it to you, Greg. Is there anything real quick that you want to touch on before we get going?
Let me think. I think I pretty much touched on everything. We've talked about all his, you know, that he's like one of those directors at every film, pretty good, even though we all kind of agreed song to song is his worst, but it's not a god-awful film. It's not like, you know, like a great director has made a terrible film, like Buddy Buddy by Billy Wilder, which is a pretty bad film, you know. But Malick has always been interesting, no matter what he does. He's an old-school art filmmaker, which is wonderful. And, you know, I didn't mention A Hidden Life. I've seen it once, and I did really like it. I remember it was released by Fox Searchlight, and it got kind of lost in the shuffle when Disney bought 20th Century Fox. I mean, they did give it a theatrical release, but they didn't give it a really, like, you know, a big one. So I didn't actually get to see that film in the theater. I usually like to see Malick films in the theater if I can. I didn't see The New World in the theater when it came out because I was actually moving to New York at the time. So, you know, going to see a movie at the time, I was too busy packing and you know, logistics and all that, moving from Chicago to New York. So I didn't really have time to go see a lot of movies at the time. So, you know. But, yeah, I think we pretty much covered everything and how he's one of the greatest he's one of the most unique directors of his generation. You know, he makes deeply spiritual pictures. And I'm looking forward to his new film if he ever finishes editing it, which he will eventually.
Yep. And what a cast
it has. Viewing soon, like at Venice or something.
Yeah, it's supposed to hit the festival circuit this year and will probably be out in the spring is what I'm hearing. So we'll see. So Carl, anything real quick that we haven't mentioned that you'd like to touch on before we go?
Just one other thing, and I did mention it very briefly, but if you ever get a chance, and I mentioned this is the first thing I ever saw that Terrence Malick was involved in, I do recommend very highly Deadhead Miles. It's a very interesting film. It's along the lines of Tulane Blacktop and The Vanishing Point, that type of thing, where Alan Arkin is a truck driver. And you can see in this film germs of some of the things that he talks about later in his own films. And, of course, he was very unhappy with this film that someone else directed it, Vernon Zimmerman. So this was the film that he made a decision that I'm going to make my own film. So it's an important film in terms of Malick. So I would recommend that film, and also as a tribute to Alan Arkin, who just passed away. So there you go.
So, you know, I'm going to mention real quick, it's an interesting little different bit of work for Malick, but Voyage of Time, his documentary narrated by Brad Pitt.
Oh, yeah, we haven't mentioned it. Yeah, we didn't mention that tonight.
I'm just going...
Boy, I found her, Adam.
It's also narrated in a longer version by Kate Blanchett. I'm going to just read the description from Wikipedia because that's easier than trying to tell you what it's about. Voyage of Time is a celebration of the universe displaying the whole of time from its start to its final collapse. This film examines all that occurred to prepare the world that stands before us now. Science and spirit, birth and death, the grand cosmos, and the minute life systems of our planet. Yeah, so that's what it's about. Apparently we are going to go into just a little bit of overtime, unless we get done right here. Aaron, anything that you want to add real quick before we go?
I was going to mention Voyage of Time. It is the rest of the remnants of the Q screenplay that he was working on in the 70s. So Tree of Life and Voyage of Time equal Q. So.
Yep. Well, in that case, I think we're going to be able to wrap this up. I think this was a great one. Thank you guys for coming in. Thank you everyone for listening. We will be back next week at the same time for Boys from the Black Stuff. And see you there. Thanks everyone. And on the count of three, good night. One, two, three, good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Bed bugs bite.